Hi everyone, welcome to STEPS audio channel. We are very excited to share our content from STEPS events to learn all about the latest trends in startups, digital media, fintech, future tech, and wellness in emerging markets. You can find us on Anagami, Spotify, and Apple Podcasts. Make sure to subscribe to your favorite channel, and we hope you enjoy the content.
Hello everyone, welcome to STEP SF. This is the first time the group has organized a conference in San Francisco. So thank you so much for the organizers. I always like to thank the hosts because I know how hard it is to bring everyone together and herd cattle. And today I have the honor of moderating this panel with incredible VCs. These guys have been in the business for a long time, and I wanted to just welcome them and give them a chance to introduce themselves, their fund, and what they are investing in. So Bain Capital.
Hi everyone, it's really great to be here. My name is Arif and I'm a partner at Bain Capital Ventures. We are focused mainly on early stage investments, seed and series A, and I personally work mainly with AI companies. I started out as a founder, started a SaaS company years ago, grew it to 100 million in ARR and then sold it to Symantec, then joined Sequoia where I was a partner for 7 years and came to Bain 4 years ago.
Hi everyone, my name is Calvin Chin. I'm one of the partners at E14 Fund. We're an early stage venture capital firm affiliated with MIT, which means we principally spin out MIT IP for about a quarter of our portfolio and then support the broad alumni community for the rest. As you might imagine, that means we're investing in a lot of deep tech, everything from material science to hardware to AI and up and down that tech stack. Principally early stage, as early as possible. We meet people first year of their graduate studies doing primary research, a couple years before they finish up an earnout at Google or wherever it might be, and we invest with conviction as early as we can. My own background, entrepreneur and operator, part of 4 startups, 2 here in the US in enterprise software, and then I was part of the early team at SMIC in China, where I spent 10 years in Shanghai. And I'm based here in Silicon Valley, although everyone always assumes they can find me in Cambridge. I'm there a lot.
Awesome. Can you guys hear us? All right, because there's no speakers pointing at us, so feel like a rock band on stage that has no idea what is happening. There's a little bit of guessing of what you just said. So this is gonna be fun. If you see us not responding to what each other says because we have no idea what this guy said.
We could really say anything about you, Bilal, you wouldn't know, which is a good part.
Or maybe I'm getting old. Bilal Zuberi here. I'm a GP at a fund called Lux Capital. We invest at the intersection of technology and sciences. That could be physical sciences, could be life sciences, could be computer sciences. So you can imagine we invest everything from semiconductor layer to application layer and so on, a lot in applications of AI. So we have fundamental model companies, but we also have infrastructure companies, and then we have companies that use AI in all kinds of applications.
Hey everyone, so I'm John Chu. I'm one of the partners at Coastal Ventures. We're a multi-stage fund, so we do any stage, but I mainly focus on seed A and B. And these days, at least related to AI, I think Coastal is most well known for being the first check into OpenAI, but we've been investing in AI companies since 2013, so we've been around for a while in the AI landscape. For me, I'm an operator by background, so I invest in basically anything I've written code on, but my first job out of college was back at this small company called Palantir when it was like 200 people, and did a bunch of data infrastructure there, and started a company in DevTools afterwards, so I sold that one to Docker, and I've seen a bit about DevOps and container infrastructure, and then I spent the next part of my career basically doing machine learning at Opendoor when it was small, and then later at Facebook. So I focus on anything that I know the area in, and that essentially is places where I've written code.
And I'm Lisa, general partner of 99VC. We're an early stage AI and data fund. In the pre-seed and seed stage is what we focus on. And the reason behind 99VC is we invest in projects that impact 99% of the world, not just the 1%. And also a silent nod to when I used to work at Microsoft Research, I worked in Building 99. And when I first moved to San Francisco, I worked in 99 Rhode Island Street and shared a building with Airbnb. So just feel like that number, it just has followed me my entire career, and it felt meaningful to kind of name my fund 99BC. So we are here to talk about AI and the investing trends, opportunities. Obviously, I know many of you are founders in AI or interested in AI. So we wanted to just, you know, give this open forum to be able to ask questions. I will be, you know, asking a couple questions about how do we navigate the AI landscape? What are some trends in technology when it comes to AI? So first question for the panelists is, what are you seeing in the technology trends in AI, and what are you most excited about?
We have to go this way first.
It could be popcorn. It doesn't have to be exactly the same.
I'll start so RF doesn't feel like he has to answer every question first. There's a lot of places people are investing in AI, and AI is frankly in almost every industry. It's where we sit, unless you're building a fundamental model, you are using AI in some way or the other. You're in some sort of an applied AI work. The most interesting thing to me personally is that there's a lot of tasks. Like, I think you will hear a lot of places where it's not just repeat tasks that can be automated, which I think we were doing with the previous versions of AI, but where it's knowledge-based tasks where the knowledge is very dispersed, unstructured, or easily unavailable, and can you change that? So even just walking down the hall, you know, when a lot of the companies that are presenting, when people are talking about, you know, building personal assistants or building engineering agents, these are all very interesting things. There's a lot of industries, I often say, there's a lot of industries that never got really infused with technology over the last 30 years. You know, when internet came in, e-commerce completely changed, communications completely changed, publishing changed, but we still make cars basically the way we made them 30 years ago. We still do construction the same way that we did 30 years ago. These are all industries where giving somebody an iPad with a very complex app, which is what SaaS was, simply didn't work. I mean, it kind of worked at the edges. But now, when you can have conversational AI, when you can have data captured and analysis done somewhere else, and then providing the output to that so that people can actually take action on it, that starts to become very interesting. So I think a vast swaths of our economy that previously were untouched by technology are going to see AI usage much faster than we anticipate.
Yeah, I agree. I agree with that. I think Bilal's point on the addressable market for software has massively expanded for that reason. The second thing that I personally am enthused about is that it's just so unpredictable. And that really helps the insurgent over the incumbent, because it's very hard to predict where things are going. A year ago, everyone was an OpenAI maxi, thinking there's going to be one model that's massively better than everything else. Today, open weight models have kept pace, and that's opened the window to create, you know, kind of like a new generation of apps and infrastructure around models that opens the way for a generation of new companies.
I completely agree with that, and I'll condense this because I actually gave this presentation to our LPs a couple months ago, but what at the bottom layer, you have the infrastructure companies like the foundation model companies, right? And that one is a little bit played out because there are incumbents. Yes, like everyone was at OpenAI Maxi before, but I think most people now are like one of four major players Maxi, including open weight models. But there's still opportunity there if you come in at really weird angles that are from left field, or if you go in really niche markets. One level up is kind of what Bilal was referring to, is essentially co-pilots, where a lot of humans will actually be augmented by machine learning. And that'll be done if you have interesting data sets that you can actually apply to task. And then one level even further up from there is essentially expertise automation. So there's companies that are going after completely automating large swaths of the job or complete roles for humans, and that opens up a lot of opportunities for people to think at a higher level. So I think those are some of the areas that essentially excite me.
And maybe just to build off of that, perhaps what you could detect is there's a lot of excitement, a lot of interesting opportunities all up and down that stack. We would entirely concur with that. I think maybe perhaps to make it actionable for a room full of founders and prospective founders, at the end of the day, while the picture is dynamic and there are huge opportunities available, there are some fundamental truths about starting a company, and I think some of those will remain and persist. So what do you know, what can you do that others cannot do? That's where you're going to be able to find opportunity. And it's not about, you know, matching your skills to whatever's most interesting to a to an investor, but where is your differentiation? What are you capable of doing? And there's likely to be investors who are interested in the disruption that's happening at that layer.
That's actually, that whole conversation last year about like OpenAI wrappers and how they're not interesting, that's essentially what you get if you just try to focus on what investors and kind of what's hot at the moment, right?
AI being a productivity accelerant, not just for serving the tech industry, but beyond. I think if you are able to look at all the old industries, right, who've operated the same for the last 30 years, and maybe the internet just gave them a digital storefront, but the way they operate their internal operations is still very much human-centered and manual. The fact that AI can be a productivity accelerant for every major industry is really exciting. You know, if AI is a productivity accelerant and productivity is a measure of GDP, we're about to level up GDP all across the board. So how do we look at those opportunities on, I think, as founders in the room, think a little bit deeper about what can you build that can serve these large industries if you can help them become 10x more productive with your tool or with your tech, that's major gains for them and for you. So that's what I see kind of as a win-win solution. Yeah. So, you know, as we're talking about startups, right, do you see valuations being frothy? Are they underpriced, overpriced? Where are you seeing the valuations land? And how can startups kind of make their deal more attractive? So that an investor can say yes.
I mean, valuations generally are stratospheric, which I know sounds exciting to an entrepreneur, but it's really a double-edged sword. And I mean, if I had one thing that I say in this talk about investors and entrepreneurs that I hope you remember is that you should really look at any financing as a recruiting decision about who do you want to work with. And just have confidence that whatever the valuation is and the terms will be a market price, because it's an active market, everyone has the same information, and it'll get priced wherever it should be. That's not a differentiator. The key thing is who you're working with and who you're living with after the investment.
This is my 16th year investing as a VC, and I don't think I've ever felt that the valuations are depressed. I think they're always too high. So I don't know what to make of that. I do believe that the most interesting thing that's number one, if somebody's giving you the money, take it, because we are in that part of the cycle where people are trying to invest in this space, and you will need more money than you think you will need. So that's an advice to founders yes, absolutely choose it from the best partner. Who do you really want as a partner? But also, this is not one of those moments where you're like, you know, I'm going to not take money because your competitors will, or something else will change, or the market opportunity may become bigger and you may want to go after it. So that's one thing. The second thing I will also say is, one of the most interesting things about this revolution, I mean, don't get me wrong, VCs talk about a new revolution every 2-3 years. We haven't forgotten that 5 years ago, AR/VR was going to change the world, and then it was crypto was going to change the world, and autonomous cars were going to change the world, and now it's AI. That's fine. The most interesting thing I find about this is that there is amazing innovation from true research onwards happening at every layer of the stack, right? So we don't know where the biggest positive surprises may come from. It may be at the compute layer, it may be in the algorithms, it may be in the application and business models or distribution or something else. You know, we are like maybe one step away from, we were chatting earlier, some new phone coming out that's like an AI agent first phone instead of the traditional operating systems where you open up apps. So innovation is happening at every layer of the stack, and billions and billions and billions of dollars are being spent every year in that. So there's a lot happening, and hence, you know, you should be investing much more open-minded on what can be built. Like, I think it's less constrained than some of the previous things or previous movements have been for young founders especially.
I'll say, like, at the end of the day, it's very much this have and have not market. There's some companies and some people that a lot of capital are chasing. There's some people that are having a difficult time finding capital. But valuation is not actually the game you should be playing, right? Like, we don't actually matter other than giving you capital to execute in terms of whether or not your business is successful. It's the customers and whether or not you're solving a real need. So the way I tend to think about capital is, like, what are the risk points in terms of what the company actually needs to accomplish to prove that your end vision is actually closer or more likely to happen than it was before? And, like, a lot of people like to say, like, raise for 18 months. And I kind of think that's stupid, right? Like, you should look at where your next risk point is, where you de-risk the company, and you should raise at least enough to get past that point or figure out if your hypothesis is correct. And if you have enough money to go to the next point, maybe you just keep going. But if not, if you've de-risked that point, now you have a point where you can go to the market and say, like, look, my company has actually done something. We're actually in a market position to raise more. And if the market is frothy at that point in time, you get a good valuation, you get money that gets you to the next step or two steps or three steps, you take it. And like Arif was saying, you should look at who you want to work with, because that's probably the most important decision. But yes, like, on the margin, you should optimize for valuation. And if you haven't hit a de-risk point, then you should figure out how you get to that de-risk point as much as possible. And, like, for good companies that have de-risked it enough that are interesting, there will always be capital available to you, right? Someone will invest in your company if you have a good company serving a real problem. But if you don't and you haven't de-risked your company, then you will run into issues.
Yeah, not much to add, except that if you are sufficiently early, even if you haven't de-risked, even if you, you know, aren't yet established as a good company or as a great investment opportunity, there's plenty of capital out there, and I firmly believe that enough persistence can find that capital or can survive long enough until you could de-risk and then be in a position where you could take capital from, you know, great branded firms at later stage. So, you know, I would encourage everybody, you know, whatever you might hear about market challenges in fund formation, growth stage being slower, et cetera, like, that's problems for you to worry about later when you're at those stages. In the meantime, there is enough early stage capital. And if you're persistent, focusing on customers, building your operations and your product the right way, there'll be plenty of time to worry about tomorrow's problems tomorrow.
So what do you actually look for when you're evaluating a founder or a startup? Is there a certain framework or data or certain attributes that you look for that might stand out?
I can go first because we're easy. We're MIT affiliated, so we look for an MIT affiliation, so you can come find us. But for that, I mean, I think we were having a great conversation, I think it was yesterday. There tend to be, you know, sort of this interesting bifurcation between, like, fundamentally deep tech, science-based AI companies, and then the rest who are maybe more on the kind of what you might think of as software engineering application side of things. So from where we sit, we do see companies across that spectrum. And for those companies that are on the deep tech, you know, frontier end, we tend to see, you know, firmly established peer-reviewed IP, likely published, people who have been working on in that domain for a long time. I'll share a funny anecdote. A lot of times you'll hear investors say, you know, go find a problem to solve and then match the appropriate technology to that problem that you found. But for this kind of company, actually the inverse is probably true. You know, while you might get pejoratively told, you know, everything looks like a nail if you've got a hammer, the truth is there are some people who've been building really fucking awesome hammers for 10 years, so they should use those hammers. That's how we tend to think about those folks. The other side of the coin, on the application layer, we see incredible founders who have decades of domain expertise and experience. They bring an understanding of not just that core product, but actually the expanded version of that product, which in, incorporates how that product might integrate or not into other systems, into workflows that go beyond the direct user of a product. That's where we tend to get more excited too.
I mean, I've walked into the room many times very skeptical about an idea or a thing based on what I've heard, and then my mind has been completely changed by the founder. I mean, it happened at Series A, at Instacart, at Zipline, a whole bunch of companies over the years where you look at it, you describe it, and it doesn't make sense when my partners talk about it. And then you hear the founder, and you just come to understand that they see something that other people haven't yet fully appreciated, and you're just drawn to that and want to be a part of it. And so that's the number one thing that I look for when I meet a founder.
I would just add what unique insight you have about in technology, or you know, via your research or whatever you've done, or about a market or a customer or a need, and will that be defensible over the long term? Like, you know, if you have that, then starts the basis of a conversation that you can build a company around it, and then immediately goes to, do you know what to do after that? Like, are you a builder? And the rest follows. You know, the questions around TAM, questions around, you know, those are all nonsensical questions, frankly, especially in these kinds of spaces. You're either looking for product market fit, and, you know, something that was a $0 trillion market becomes big, or you have a very well-defined problem, hair's cancer, if you solve it, it'll be really nice. You know that people will buy that drug, but you don't know if you can solve that problem. I think the biggest thing becomes, do you have something very unique to bring to that, and can you then build a company around it? A lot of people I meet, everybody who comes to a $1 billion fund, a multi-billion dollar fund, usually has figured out that the problem that they're working on is like a very large and important problem. They may not be able to define it in dollars, but it seems like a pretty important problem. And they can see the forest, but often they don't know what to do next or how to build the trees that lead up to that forest. What are the steps that need to be taken? Or otherwise, you see people with 20 years of experience in some industry, like automotive or whatever, so they understand everything, how GM works or Ford works or whatever. But they, and then hence they can do the next few things, but they can't really put it all together into why this is a big deal and what's the bigger picture in which we're solving. So having founders that can have the bigger picture and then start building towards it, that's a pretty unique attribute, and you'd be surprised how few people can get that done right. Now, some people, you know, I may not see that, but John might see that, and John might invest in, I may not, which is why we have all these venture funds, because everybody has a slightly different taste in what they're looking for.
I think that covers a lot of it. I'll just add, like, the high level is, can this be a generational company, and are these the right people to do it, right? And there's many different ways you can think about that, like Bill L. saying, is there a contrarian angle or whatnot, or RF saying, like, focus on the founders themselves, or you can look at the market size and whatnot. But at the end of the day, the question everyone's going to ask is this a generational company, and are these the right people to make that happen?
Yeah, I think for me, I practice a framework called the 4 T's. I look at, of course, tech. I only invest in tech startups. Is there a technical component? And for this fund specifically, is AI a core piece of technology in that startup? We look at the TAM. Obviously, it has to be a large target addressable market, $1 billion or more. Otherwise, we won't see the venture scale that we want. And we also look at, you know, the traction. Have the startup been able to see early signs of product market fit? Have you been able to attract customers? Do you understand your customers? Are they paying you for your services? Are they giving you time? Is there retention? So it's not just spend the dollars CAC, you know, formula, but I also want to dive a little bit deeper in, after you've acquired the customer, are you able to retain them? Is there kind of this stickiness about your product? And then, of course, the team is super important. I think as an early stage fund, you know, I've been very pleasantly surprised too by founders who just believe so core deeply about an idea. They see something you don't see. And if they're able to convince investors that this is either a new market or something needs to change, and they're the champion of that, I think finding those investment partners who believe in your vision, that are aligned, that can actually supercharge your vision and take it forward is what you want to look for in a firm. And every firm has a different flavor or preference, but so important to feel aligned and not just take money from anyone. They have to really be able to buy in your vision and support that. So let's dive a little bit deeper into what are some actual like startups or sectors that you've invested in and where you might have kind of seen them super early before anyone have seen them and how they've kind of grown. And what are those, what made those companies successful? I think that's what I'm curious to hear about.
Let's go first. I can go first. There's a company called Applied Intuition. You're doing a lot of work in autonomous cars. Autonomous cars don't really function if you don't have AI, so on. So I'm taking that angle because it's different than what we usually hear about, which is, you know, open AI or other fundamental models or foundational models and companies built on top. The fundamental insight that they had was that one of the leading technology companies at that point in AI and others is Google, right? I mean, we may laugh at them, but they have fundamentally been doing AI work for a decade or more. And they realize that the amount of compute that they use for powering their Waymo cars is incredible. It's like several percentage points of all Google's available compute. When you think about that, you say, holy shit. Two things come out of it. Number one, the complexity of what they're doing, they were doing all kinds of simulations and stuff. The complexity of the technology required is probably, this is the founding team realized, that is likely does not exist inside Ford and GM and Hyundai and everyone, right? Like Google has it, maybe one or two other companies have it, but the 16 to 20 to 25 automotive companies around the world don't have that technical talent. And then two, the complexity of the infrastructure that's going to be required in addition to the software. That's also, again, you know, Google can build data centers, but, you know, a random company in Bulgaria that wants to be an autonomous car company is not going to be able to do that, or at least not easily. So they started building in that space. And that was very specific insight, very specific capabilities that they built around it and the team they built. And they've been able to build a multi-hundred million revenue, multi-billion dollar profitable company that's one of the darlings in Silicon Valley, right? Now, compared to them, there was a lot of companies that were started off as, we need to build the operating system for the car, we need to have this big idea. They were great teams too, and they had big plans. But they said they did not have anything very unique insight. What they were trying to do was, I want to build this large operating system, big idea, raised a lot of money, because some VCs love the big idea, but there was nothing specific they could do. And a lot of them burned through a lot of money, and then, you know, either struggling or have already passed away, right? That, I think, is what it takes for you to be building a business. It's something very specific, very knowledgeable, that allows you to get to the customer, get the revenues, have a real product, and have a real traction that tells you where the industry is really going, versus BSing to VCs who may buy your story but can't really help you build a product or find customers. Like you want to say something.
You get to brag about some of your portfolio companies right here.
That's a good lesson. I guess like...
You were investors in OpenAI, right? Okay, and that was sure. Early. There was no... It wasn't like, here's my product, here's my customer, here's what I'm going to build.
Well, I can talk through like the logic behind the OpenAI one. And that one was a very interesting bet in the sense that like when we invested in OpenAI, the pitch was kind of like, we need $50 million. We burn money every month in quite a bit of it, and we make $0. So it's like, yes, you should give us money, and you should give it to us at a high valuation. And the logic behind there was essentially, well, what is the actual vision that this company has? And like ChatGPT and whatnot was never actually the vision. The vision is like, we want to make AGI, right? And the logic and the thought process that the firm actually had was, well, if you're going to invest in a company that can build AGI, there's only like four research labs in the world you can invest in. One of them's in China and we can't do that. The other ones are public. So like, this is the only bet you have, right? And are these people actually good enough researchers to have a shot at pulling that off? And the answer was yes. So to, really, this is to Ilya's credit. Originally, when they pitched us, the whole thing was based off of LSTMs, and it was like, yes, LSTMs are gonna be the answer, and they will actually scale, right? But they kept very core to the fact that this is a research organization, a technology company, and the goal is to actually get to AGI. And the hypothesis is the fact that neurons in brains work a certain way. There's many more neurons in a brain than anyone that's ever tried anything before. So the whole point is scale. If you can fix the scaling laws, then it works. So the moment they saw the transformer, they just completely 180'd all their research and went towards a transformer because that thing scales better, right? And turns out, like, yes, that was a great research direction. And yes, that actually ends up in something that is not really AGI, right? But like, looks very interesting. But I think the points that worked really well for OpenAI for the longest time was being very core to the vision of AGI, realizing that that wasn't something that needed to be in market for a long time, but needed core research and to spend their cycles on research, and remembering that their original hypothesis was this particular thing about scaling and not being married to any particular technology.
I mean, I can give a more recent example of a company that started about 16, 17 months ago. It's called Contextual, and we have an initiative called BCV Labs, so Bain Capital Ventures Labs, where we incubate companies and work with people right at inception. And this was one of the companies where we did that, where the two founders had just left Hugging Face. They'd done some of the seminal work on RAG, Retrieval Augmented Generation, which now is fairly well known. At that time, people were wondering if it was the right approach. We'd read the papers and believed that this would become the dominant approach, and so helped them incorporate and start a company around their ideas. It's only, we're only 15 months in. We led the seed round. They've now got, 50 people, a dozen customers, several million in revenue, and have raised a big follow-on round to help fund all of that. And so it's early days, much earlier than these two companies, but to me it just speaks to just the latent demand for AI solutions in enterprises. They walk into large companies and all the usual objections, security reviews, SSO integration, all the nonsense just doesn't apply. And they're able to sign quite large deals with big banks and other people in a way that just wasn't possible before. And it just gives me tremendous optimism that this is a moment in time when there's a chance for companies to get going and grow very quickly.
Maybe I'll share an early company as well. It is sort of the part of the growth of the companies, and we've got companies who've had unicorn exits and hundreds of millions of dollars of revenue as well. But we do still have a lot of affection for that earliest stage. A company about a year old that coincidentally was founded by three people who we knew very, very deeply. And so we could know their complementarity and just how they were the right team for this problem. The founder CEO actually hired my partner Habib when he first got out of grad school 20 years ago. The second was a faculty at MIT who did his PhD with the CEO, but who we knew at CSAIL at MIT. And the third happened to be a postdoc in his lab who took our workshop called Beyond the Lab and was learning about entrepreneurship a year before the company got started. And because we knew the team so deeply, we knew that with the published work out of that lab, they're the only ones or the best ones to build generative AI for design and manufacturing. And so what they've built now is an intelligence layer on top of multiple models and multiple modalities to take 2D images and then generate 3D instructions, to build parts lists, to do all the instructions. And take what would typically be oftentimes the most odious part of hardware engineering or industrial engineering, the part that people literally draw straws to see who has to do that at the end of a project, and then turn it into minutes of work instead. Early company, but now about 10 employees, first customers, exciting design work, and then already scaling up, you know, towards that totality of the vision, which includes multiple products that we'll be launching soon as well.
You should introduce me to that company, Calvin.
We have a shared company. Maybe you can talk about it a little bit, Sakana. And I say that because this is a foundational model company based in Japan. So a lot of the stuff we've talked about, like, you know, one way to get funded is to be an MIT alum and an MIT PhD and an MIT postdoc and maybe an OpenAI alum. But this is a different set of people in a different language. Maybe you can talk about it a little bit, like sort of what is special about that kind of company? Because I do think that there's a lot of founders here who are actually building their companies outside the US as well.
Yeah, I mean, I'd actually love to hear, Bilal, where your guys' logic was, because I don't think we ever actually crossed notes after we did the round together. But for us, like, so Sakana essentially is a foundation model for Japan. And even at the time we did it, it was kind of obvious that it was going to be hard to compete against players like OpenAI, Anthropic, and whatnot. So you really needed to find an angle on why this company would be successful. And where we landed and why we got the conviction here was two things. Essentially, like, yes, there's a technical angle. Doing this for Asian languages, like the tokenizer has to change. You'll probably have a slight lead on OpenAI, et cetera, but that's like not the actual reason we did it. The actual reason is Japan is the third largest economy in the world.
Fourth.
And if you don't count like the EU as one giant economy. The country is actually hyper-nationalistic. So I've spent a lot of time there, and it's actually like not okay to speak English in a room with English speakers if they're actually there. And they're doubling their national defense budget every single year for like the next 10 years. You know, the government is not someone that's going to use OpenAI, because if you get into an argument with the US, you'll just turn it off, right? So you have this captive market. And if you look at the team is basically perfectly suited for this. You have the guy that wrote essentially what became the Laura paper. You have one of the guys that's on the Transformers paper. And then you have a third co-founder who's a former Japanese politician. So it kind of just like matches up perfectly for taking over this market. And that's really how we got conviction on it.
I think it's really interesting. We have not traded notes, even though we're co-investors in the company. Yes, there's a whole bunch of technical, you know, I mean, they publish, you know, they just published an AI scientist, and they're doing really cutting edge work on blended models and all kinds of stuff. But yes, the primary reason was that if AI is going to affect every industry, financial industry, life sciences, drug development, military defense, and we invest in all of those things, you're not going to have a country the size of Japan put all their data into a Meta-owned model or OpenAI model or whoever model. They're going to, you just can't. You can't afford to do that. And that was the idea. So what needs to happen? And that's where we started looking. And it wasn't like, let's just build another OpenAI, but with different tokenization scheme. But it was like, there's got to be a different thing. And then the team composition really mattered. Like, they needed to understand some of the other industries they're going after. They're not just building a ChatGPT for Japanese language.
Oh, this is a great example, which is a great segue into what's next, right? Now that we've invested in AI companies, some longer than others, we've kind of seen some of these baby AGI companies grow into revenue-generating businesses. What do you see as kind of that next step change? You know, is it post-AGI? How far are we from AGI? Want to definitely get opinions from Kosla, but what do you see is that next big opportunity as AI becomes, you know, more mainstream?
I guess I can start. The AGI kind of conversation is one where I personally never take a huge stance on. It's like, yes, at the pace of technology, it depends on what you define as AGI, but potentially hard takeoff happens in 5 to 10 years, potentially not. It's kind of a nice problem to think about, but it doesn't really impact how you think about your business or how you think about investing, maybe in the long term, but maybe not the short term. I think how this works in general, though, is you have this interesting technology that allows you to actually automate things, and there's still going to be research that happens, and there's still going to be potentially shifts that happen at the foundational model layer. Like, for example, you might have a different model that comes in from left field using a completely different approach, like neurosymbolic models. And that changes the GPU landscape, and that changes the cost of training and what can actually be done in terms of things like hallucinations. But that level is mostly set unless something happens from left field. And now you're moving up the stack and seeing like, okay, where are things as you go up the application layer that is possible now with this technology? And that's what a lot of, actually just walking the floor here, that's what a lot of you guys are thinking about, right? It's like, in these old industries, what is possible to be done that couldn't be done before? And how do you take that opportunity and build moats? And I think that's where a lot of the interesting opportunity actually lies. And then on the side note is like, there are still a bunch of areas that are not AI related that are overlooked. So those areas get more interesting as everybody migrates towards AI.
Yeah, I mean, I have no idea about AGI, but the two near-term things that look interesting along the lines of what John was talking about, for me, one is multimodal models that is text to images, and you could just do so much more with that in terms of the problems that you could solve. And then secondly, intelligent reasoning, where we're not quite there yet. People call them agents, if you like, but we're making progress, and it looks like there'll be, again, that software will be able to do much more on the reasoning front in the next couple of years than it has been able to do historically. And I think, just again, building on what John was saying, you take those things and you say, we haven't yet seen truly AI-native applications. And that's because it just takes time to digest these things. But with these new capabilities, if you look back at mobile as an example, the iPhone came out in 2007. We didn't get, you know, Uber or Snapchat until 2009 or 2010. It takes 2-3 years for people to digest a new platform. And I think we're hitting that right as these models are becoming more powerful. And so I'm, you know, again, optimistic that the applications we see over the next couple of years will be much more unusual, interesting, surprising, impactful than anything we've seen yet.
Totally agree with all of those comments. Maybe the one thing I might add is that I think... you know, it's a bit like we've bought all the ingredients and now we need to cook the meal as well. So I think there's a lot of hard work to build the impact that a lot of the companies that have already received a lot of funding and a lot of the applications that are being built and the transformations that can be enabled. And I think it's a lot of interesting, exciting operational things ahead of us. And even like a small prosaic example, like a lot of companies have to rethink how they're going to do pricing. Like per seat developer pricing is... a misalignment between the productivity and the automation that you confer to your customer, the value that you create for your customer, and then the value that you capture for yourself. So I think there's going to be a lot of really interesting changes in how a lot of the things we've kind of accepted as the way things are done will be done going forward.
I'll just say a couple of, you know, concrete examples for us. We just, you know, funded a company, it's still in stealth a little bit, around truly distributed compute. So there's a lot of work happening, as I said, at the fundamental level and coming out of research labs, out of the top universities. Like, you know, you will hear everybody talk about Elon's building the gigafactory equivalent for training models, and the models are becoming bigger and you need bigger and bigger, and they all have to be available at all times. You can't like start and stop trainings easily. So how can you now take all of that compute that happens on the inference side and the training side for large models and make it completely distributed? So there's a lot of work that's happening. You know, obviously we've learned from previous generations on when distributed compute became available and what got unlocked. So there's some stuff happening there. The second thing I would say is that whether it's AGI or not, if AI is going to be in every part of our life, one of the things I am personally passionate about and I have invested in several companies in that space is things related to privacy, security, and ethics. There's a nonsensical debate in tech Twitter, at least, if not tech community, around regulations or non-regulations, and you're for regulations and government capture and whatever the other crap is. The reality is that these things are going to affect our lives in very meaningful ways. All of our data is out. I think just yesterday somebody released all our social security numbers, right? Like, so there was some mishap that happened. That means, you know, I can actually, because one of my company does that, that's their sales gimmick, I can give you a phone number to call, it will read out your name, it will read out your address, and it will read out your social security number, right? I can do that today, meet me afterwards if you want to, right? So all your information is public. That should not be okay. And it should be, you know, yeah, 10 years ago people were like, oh, the next generation doesn't really care about privacy and all that. That's not true. Next generation actually will care about privacy. Because it's one thing if your friends know whether you've slept that night or not, or whether you're sleeping with somebody or not. It's a completely different animal when it can be used politically against you, especially if you live in countries where this can be, you know, really dangerous, life-threatening dangerous for you, right? So these are things that we're not paying enough attention to right now, at least in this country, because we're just like pushing the frontiers of technology, rightfully so. But I think there are companies to be built that are going to be responsible for that and allow technology to enable that to happen. Understanding ethics, understanding, you know, how security could be, you know, you could, when you have code that's writing code, you have no idea. In open source systems, we see this all the time. What malicious code is being injected inside that could hold your data for 10 years before releasing it to somebody else, right? So, or activate things, right? All, you know, 80% of chips that we use in our home come from a country that's now considered a hostile country. What AI is sitting on that? Like all of us, you know, I remember I have a lot pretty tightly, and I'll shut up with my rant here. I have a pretty tight, you know, because I invest a lot in defense and security stuff. So I have a pretty tight control on my cybersecurity at home and what devices we use and this and that stuff, right? So I do all of that. And then I come home one afternoon and my daughter has bought some stupid radio Bluetooth speaker online for $20. And the first thing she does is gives it the username and password to our Wi-Fi to get it connected. Suddenly, some random $20 device that she bought off the internet has the username password to my Wi-Fi Ethernet. Now, you might may think it means nothing, but I can tell you I have seen companies coming out of countries where there's warfare going on, where if they have access to that information, they have access to a lot of your devices on that circuit, right? So I think those become very important areas to invest in, and I think a lot of entrepreneurs that are not doing fundamental research work are going to start thinking about these things because people will start paying for that.
Great points. Well, thank you, you guys, for a dynamic conversation. Hope everyone learned a lot today. And you can find all of us online if you want to reach out.
Thank you for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed the episode. You can find our content on Anghami, Spotify, and Apple Podcast. Follow us on social media at Step Conference, and let's stay in touch.